I'm really glad to be back in Davis. I call it my annual pilgrimage, sometime in March or April. So probably the most important open question in our field is, what is the dynamics that drives the electroweak phase transition? And broadly speaking, there are two possibilities. One is that electroweak symmetry is broken by a light Higgs, and the other is that electroweak symmetry is broken by some kind of strong dynamics in analogy to GCD, and that in that case there is no light Higgs. So the positional electroweak data at this time would seem to favor a light Higgs, in which case you are immediately faced with the question of what is it that protects the Higgs mass parameter against quadratic divergences from higher scales. And one possibility is that the Higgs is some kind of a composite pseudo-Goldstone, similar to the pion in QCD. Now the problem, now this idea has been around for more than 30 years, and there's an immediate obstacle which makes it hard to realize the Higgs this way as a composite. And the problem is that positional electroweak data tells you that the compositeness scale has to be greater than about 5 TeV. And that's because when you integrate out new physics at the compositeness scale, you expect to generate operators such as these. And the bounds on the scale lambda in the denominator tell you that the compositeness scale should be greater than about 5 TeV. And then you're immediately faced with the problem that radiative corrections from 5 TeV would immediately generate a Higgs mass much larger than 200 TeV, which is the positional electroweak upper bound. So to understand this, let's consider QCD with just two light flavors, the up quark and the down quark. So in the limit that the quark masses are zero, the theory has an SU2 left cross SU2 right global symmetry, which is broken down to the diagonal SU2. So even when the quark masses are zero, electromagnetism still breaks SU2 cross SU2. So only U1 cross U1 subgroup of this SU2 cross SU2 symmetry is exact. Now, the neutral pion is massless because this is an exact symmetry, the U1 cross U1. But the charged pions acquire a mass at one loop, which is a loop factor smaller than the QCD scale. Now, if you were to construct a similar model for the Higgs, which is actually not very hard to do, the analogous formula for the mass of the Higgs would be a loop factor smaller than the compositeness scale. But the biggest symmetry breaking effect would be the top Yukawa coupling. And so that's the parameter that appears there. And there's also a color factor of 3. And once you put this all in, what you find is that for a compositeness scale of 5 TeV, the Higgs mass would be 1 TeV, which is well above the positional electroweak upper bound. And unless you have cancellations at the 1 or 2% level, you're out of luck. This is not a compelling theory. So the bottom line is that theories with a composite pseudo-Goldstone Higgs seem to be disfavored unless there is some mechanism which suppresses these contributions to the Higgs mass. And this is where the little Higgs idea comes in. So let's go back to QCD with two light flavors. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to change the electric charge assignments of the quarks, but very slightly. So instead of the up quarks having a charge 2/3, I give them a charge of 1/2. And I give the down quarks a charge of minus 1/2. And what I do is I gauge U1 symmetry separately on the left-handed quarks and the right-handed quarks. So the gauge symmetry is now U1 left cross U1 right. And because these charges are now plus 1/2 and minus 1/2, this charge assignment is actually anomaly free. So to summarize, under U1 left, U left has charge 1/2, d left has charge minus half, u right, d right are zero. Under u1 right, the up right-handed up quark has half, down right-handed down has minus a half, u left, d left are both zero. So this is the charge assignment I choose under the two different u1s. And this charge assignment is actually anomaly free. So again, the strong dynamics takes over and breaks SU2 left cross SU2 right down to the diagonal SU2. And the U1 left cross U1 right will again be broken down to the diagonal U1, which I now label this as electromagnetism. And one of the Goldstone bosons, which is the neutral pion, is eaten now because this symmetry was gauged. But the two charged pions surviving the low energy theory as pseudo Goldstone bosons, exactly like in QCD. And their charge is plus minus one, just like in QCD. So the only real difference in the low energy spectrum is that previously we had, if you look at the previous theory, we had a massless neutral pion, but now that guy is eaten. And you still have two charged pions. And if you look at the mass of the charged pions, what you find is that it's given by this formula. And the difference between the formula we had before and this formula is that there is an extra loop factor suppression in the mass. And it's a loop factor smaller than in real QCD. So this is the formula we had before for the mass of the charged pion. And this is the formula we have now in this slightly different theory. So the bottom line is you can have a charged particle a charged composite pseudo-Goldstone whose mass is smaller by a loop factor than in the charged pion in QCD, but although the differences in the theory are actually not that big, okay, when you compare it to QCD. So what is the origin of the suppression of the mass in this theory as opposed to the previous theory? So the idea is that in the limit that the electric charge E left of the left-handed quarks is zero, the SU2 left symmetry is exact. And so after symmetry breaking, there have to be three massless Goldstone bosons corresponding to the breaking of that symmetry. And one of those is eaten. And the two charged pions are exactly massless in this limit. Similarly, in the limit that this is zero, the SU2R symmetry is exactly, the charged pions remain massless after symmetry breaking. So the idea is that the charged pions are massless if either E left or E right is zero. And so the charged pions can only get masses from diagrams that involve both E left and E right. And any such diagram must involve both the left and right gauge bosons. And such diagrams turn out to be suppressed by at least two loop factors. And that's what explains why the suppression in the previous formula. So this underlying concept is called collective symmetry breaking. Both the SU2 left symmetry, you need interactions that break both the SU2 left symmetry and the SU2 right symmetry explicitly before the charged pion can get a mass. So this is the underlying mechanism behind the little Higgs. So you can obtain a diagrammatic understanding of this result. The mass of the charged pion from electromagnetism is cancelled by diagrams involving the heavy U1 prime gauge boson. So this is what we want to do. So we want to apply this idea to obtain a light Higgs as a composite pseudo-Goldstone. Now the challenge is that most little Higgs theories have been constructed only as nonlinear sigma models. So it's far from obvious that the corresponding dynamics can be obtained through strong dynamics. Okay. So what I want to show is how the simplest little Higgs can be realized as a composite pseudo-Goldstone. So this is one specific little Higgs theory, and what I want to show is how to get that as a composite pseudo-Goldstone. So before I do that, let me explain what exactly the simplest little Higgs is. So consider a model where the SU2 cross U1 gauge symmetry of the standard model is enlarged to a global SU3 cross U1 with the SU2 cross U1 subgroup gauged. And the standard model is the pseudo-Goldstone boson associated with the breaking of the global symmetry. And the reason I'm gauging SU2 cross U1 is that if I gauge the full SU3 cross U1, all the Goldstones would be eaten. So I parameterize the Goldstone bosons associated with the breaking of the global symmetry in this way. And here, this field H is a doublet under the unbroken SU2. So you have zeros here in F. And so the field H is a doublet under the unbroken SU2. And that's the field I'm going to identify as the standard model Higgs. So the low energy effective theory for the Goldstone bosons will consist of all operators involving this field phi, consistent with the non-linearly realized SU3 cross U1 symmetry. So the interactions of the pseudo-Goldstones will arise from these gauge covariant kinetic terms. And these interactions don't have an SU3 cross U1 invariant form because I gauged only the SU2 cross U1 subgroup. And as a consequence, if you start looking at contributions to the mass of H, the small h, pseudo-Goldstone, you'll find diagrams like this. And the radiatively generated mass is of order this much. And this is unsatisfactory. It's a loop factor below the compositeness scale, or the cutoff scale. And it scales just like the pion in QCD. And that's not what we want. Right. So there's a simple, just like in the previous case, there was a simple modification of the QCD, of QCD, which gave rise to a light pseudo-Goldstone. There's a modification of this theory which also gives rise to a light pseudo-Goldstone. And what you do is this. You break SU3 cross U1 to SU2 cross U1 twice. So the pattern of breaking is then SU3 cross U1 mod SU2 cross U1 whole squared. And this time you gauge the full vector SU3 cross U1 subgroup of the larger global symmetry. And the standard model Higgs will again be the pseudo-Goldstone associated with the breaking of the global symmetry. So this theory was written down by Schmaltz. So now because you're breaking this symmetry twice, you have two sets of pseudo-Goldstones which are labeled as phi1 and phi2. And the associated pions are pi1 and pi2, and you know, these are the field objects which transform linearly. And interactions of the pions will arise from these covariant kinetic terms. And this is the difference between the model I just talked about and this one is that now these dmus have gauged the full SU3 cross U1, a full SU3 cross U1 symmetry. Now, again, explicit calculation shows that the quadratic divergences arising from loops involving the SU2 cross U1 gauge bosons, that's loops like this, which are there in the standard model, are cancelled by these loops involving the SU3 cross U1 mod SU2 cross U1 gauge bosons. And at the first non-vanishing contribution to the mass comes at this order. And you can see, again, that you have two loop factors in front of the compositeness scale square. So this model now does what you want. And it's a loop factor than smaller than before. So for a cutoff of order 10 TeV, the Higgs mass parameter is now weak scale size. And again, you can understand the origin of this cancellation as related to collective symmetry breaking. So the relevant interactions have this form. So let's denote the gauge coupling constant. So so you have these two sets of interactions. Now let me label this coupling constant by G1 and that one by G2. In the limit that G1 is zero, this set of interactions vanishes. And so the model has an exact SU3 cross U1 global symmetry, which is broken to SU2 cross U1. And so there are five massless Goldstone bosons. Similarly, if I set that to zero and leave only that one, there's a different exact SU2 cross U1 global symmetry. And there are again five exactly mass dispersed from bosons. So for the Goldstone bosons to acquire a mass, both these couplings must be non-zero. And therefore, you need diagrams involving both sets of couplings, G1 and G2. And it turns out there is no quadratically divergent contribution to the pseudo-Goldstone mass at one loop that involves both those sets of couplings. And this is why there is, you know, the contribution is suppressed. So again, the symmetry of which the Higgs is a pseudo-Goldstone is explicitly broken by the base couplings, but only collectively. And this is why the Higgs mass is protected in this theory. So it's possible to extend this mechanism to Yukawa couplings as well. We promote the standard model SU2 doublets to triplets or anti-triplets as required. And you also need some additional new fermions. And then the uptype Yukawa couplings take this form. So here Q, which contains the SU2 doublet quarks in the standard model, is promoted to a triplet under SU3. So triplet and triplet, anti-triplet, and so this U1 is a singlet. And the standard model SU2 singlets are a linear combination of this of U1 and D2. And the theory has an exact global symmetry in the limit that either Y1 or Y2 is zero. And so in terms of the Higgs mass is again protected by collective breaking. And the standard model Yukawa loop, which is that one, is cancelled by a new by a loop containing the new states contained in this triplet and the other linear combination of U1 and U2. So this cancels that. Now at the end of the day, for a compositeness scale of 5 TeV, the fine-tuning is of order 1 part in 10. It's an order of magnitude better than the naive estimate for composite Higgs. So the next step is going to be to construct a theory where the pattern of symmetry breaking I've been talking about is realized through strong dynamics. So in other words, if one can get this pattern of symmetry breaking through strong dynamics, then one has realized a composite little Higgs model. The fine-tuning is an order of magnitude better than in a naive composite Higgs model. So why is this difficult? The problem is this: if you try to realize a composite simplest little Higgs, you are immediately faced with a very serious obstacle. See, one of the operators allowed by the symmetry breaking pattern is this one. And it turns out that in the strong coupling limit, this coefficient is around 16 pi squared. And this operator violates the custodial SU2 symmetry of the standard model. So what it does is to alter the ratio of the W and Z masses from the standard model prediction. And then if you put a bound on this operator, if C is 16 pi squared, it tells you that the compositeness scale has to be more than 50 TeV. So this is the problem. And now if you take this at face value, strongly coupled UV completions of the simplest little Higgs would seem to be strongly disfavored at face value.
Do we know how big that operator is in QCD?
No, I don't know how to. I also don't know how to estimate it in QCD because the pattern is different, right? This is SU3 cross U1 to SU2 cross U1. Whereas QCD is SU3 cross SU3 to. In fact, I don't think this operator arises in QCD. I think in QCD you need, because it's bi doublet, so you need. Everything comes with derivatives. But just like in the standard model, you know, if you have SU2 cross U1 broken to U1, you can have an operator like this. So I don't see any reason why this one, which is SU3 cross U1 to SU2 cross U1, shouldn't be there. But you're right. In QCD, I don't think this operator is even there. All right. However, there is a way out. So consider a linear realization of this symmetry breaking pattern. So here, phi 1 and phi 2 are scalar fields which transform as fundamentals under the SU2 plus 1 phase symmetry. So the crucial observation is that, so just turn off the gauge interactions and just write this out, this set of interactions for phi 1, write it out in terms of real and imaginary fields. So phi 1 is complex, just write it out in terms of real and imaginary fields. And so phi 1 is a triplet of SU3, and so that means it's complex. So you write it out in terms of real and imaginary fields. There are six objects in there. And it turns out that this Lagrangian, once you remove the gauge symmetries, is invariant under an O6 global symmetry. And that O6 global symmetry is broken to O5. When phi 1 gets over there. So the five Goldstone bosons that you get when phi 1 gets a wave, up to now we have been saying, well, those Goldstone bosons come because you broke SU3 cross U1 to SU2 cross U1. But you could just as well have said, well, they're coming from the breaking of O6 to O5. So the quantum numbers of the Goldstone bosons under the non-linearly realized SU3 cross U1, which is the gauge symmetry. So the gauge quantum numbers of the Goldstone bosons are the same whether you believe they came from O6 to O5 or SU3 cross U1 to SU2 cross U1. And the same is true for phi 2. There again, the symmetry is O6 to O5.
Is that because I can obviously embed SU3 cross U1 and SU4, which is the same as O6, and SU2 cross U1 embeds in SP4?
It's not related, that's true, but that's not really
that's
related
not right.
to that, you know. For example, the same thing happens, for example, in the twin Higgs model, right, where you break SU4 to SU3. There again, you have a similar problem with custodial SU2. Because SU4 to SU3 doesn't have a custodial SU2. But once again, if you write on the linear model, what you see is that it has O8 to O7 pattern, which does, for example, contain custodial SU2. So it's just true that the linear models for these SUN breaking to SUN minus 1 actually has O2N to O2N minus 1 symmetries. This turns out to be true. So once we gauge SU3 cross U1, 5 of the 10 Goldstone bosons are just eaten as before. So consider now a model where the breaking of O6 to O5 is realized through strong dynamics. Since this pattern preserves custodial SU2, because O4 is contained in O5, right? The unwanted operators are forbidden in the low energy effective theory, even though the number of Goldstone bosons, 5, and their gauge quantum numbers are exactly the same as in the original simplest little Higgs. So this is the basic idea. SU3 cross U1 breaking to SU2 cross U1. And O6 breaking to O5 with SU3 cross U1 gauged give rise to Goldstone bosons with exactly the same gauged quantum numbers in the two cases. So, and this pattern actually does have custodial SU2. So in this scenario, the bad operators, the ones that break custodial SU2, can only be generated through loops involving interactions that break the custodial symmetry. That is through gauge and Yukawa interactions. And in that case, the coefficient C of the bad operator is order 1, rather than, actually, this should be 16 pi squared, not 4 pi. It should be 4 pi squared. And so the compositeness scale can again be as low as 5 keV. So then here's the challenge. Find a way to, do UV complete the simplest little Higgs? Find a way to break O6 to O5 by strong dynamics. So here's where the O6 SU4 thing comes in. That's why this one is doable, whereas the others are hard. So O6 and SU4 have the same Lie algebra, as do O5 and SP4. So then the problem is to break SU4 to SP4 through strong dynamics. And consider an SU2 gauge theory with four fields in the fundamental representation. So here alpha is, pardon?
This is the minimal technicolor that doesn't work, right? People said, you know what I'm talking about?
No, I don't know what you're talking about.
One of Peskin's old papers. He looked at this model and said, got this pattern of breaking.
Mm-hmm.
It said it was a candidate technicolor theory, and this pattern of breaking shows that it won't work as technicolor.
Because
it breaks like a weakened long pattern. There was this assumption how it was gauged. Never mind, go ahead.
Alright, okay, I want to know about this, but alright. Okay. So consider an SU2 gauge theory. Actually, here the pattern of breaking, because it's a little Higgs theory, is I think not, you know, this, it's not very, it's, you, from the effective field theory point of view, you have a lot of control. But anyway, let me go ahead. So consider an SU2 gauge theory with four fields in the fundamental representation. Okay. Here alpha is an SU2 color index, while I is a flavor index and takes values 1 through 4. So when the SU2 gauge theory gets strong, you get a condensate along the SU2 singlet direction. So this is the SU2 singlet direction. And J is this matrix. And the crucial point is that J is anti-symmetric in the flavor indices I and J. So what happens is you end up breaking the SU4 global symmetry down to SP4. So to break SU4 to SP4 twice, just begin with two different copies of Xi1 and Xi2, each with four fields in the fundamental. And you end up with two separate anti-symmetric condensates resulting in the desired pattern. So we are free to gauge a vector SU3 cross U1 subgroup of the SU4 cross SU4 global symmetry. So a little bit of this is obscure, but here's the idea. So you have two different SU2 groups, each with four flavors. And so there's an SU4 cross SU4. So you have two different SU4s, but you're gauging a common SU3 cross U1 subgroup of these two SU4 flavor symmetries. So how this works in detail, you take the indices 1, 2, and 3 to be SU3 indices, while 4 is an SU3 singlet. So the SU3 gauge symmetry will be anomaly free provided the fields in Xi1 transform in the fundamental representation of SU3, while those in Xi2 transform in the anti-fundamental. So it turns out that once you do that, it's anomaly free. And you choose the U1 charge assignments in such a way that SU4 contains SU3 cross U1, so the U1 charge assignments are proportional to the extra diagonal generator, and you just normalize them in such a way that once it condenses, you get hypercharge, which is straightforward to do. So after condensation, the SU3 cross U1 gauge symmetry breaks down to the SU2 cross U1 of the standard model. So,
so if we look at just one of the SU2 strong interactions,
mm-hmm. Everything is even.
So there's four fields. How do they transform under the final SU2 left? Is it clear?
There are four fields. Okay. Okay, so if you just look at one of them, there are five Goldstone bosons.
I'm talking about the original strongly interacting fields. Just trying to understand how you gauge the subgroup.
How did I gauge the subgroup?
Maybe it's too technical.
No.
Understand?
It's probably very fair. If you just apply the most naive, the smack analysis, the most attractive chain analysis, prefer to solve condensate, which has a singlet under SU3. I mean, you have to prevent each of them. I guess it doesn't probably relate to what has to find it doesn't work or something, but then this is an assumption. Do you get the right attendance in that?
Here's the way I look at it, okay? If you just take one of them, there are no Goldstone bosons left over. Every single thing is eaten. So there's no direction you can move in field space which would alter the pattern. So if you believe that SU4 is broken to SP4, then once you've made that assumption, then if I gauge SU3 cross U1, that breaks to SU2 cross U1. There is no freedom left. Probably what Peskin did was to gauge SU2 cross U1, because he needed something left over. And then you have an alignment question, because there'll be some Goldstone bosons left over, and it's not clear which direction you're sitting.
Yeah, so I'm just trying to figure out what in the SU4,
mm-hmm.
what parts of it became threes and.
Okay. Right. So let me see. So I have Xi alpha 1, so Xi alpha 1, Xi alpha 2, Xi alpha 3, and Xi alpha 4. Right? So these three I made into a triplet. This is an SU3 singlet. Okay. Now, so I have epsilon alpha beta, Xi alpha I, Psi beta j. So you can see that if I have a 4 here, this has to be 1, 2, or 3 because of the anti-symmetry. Right. So this is definitely a 3 of SU3, which is getting a web.
Right.
So
do you have one that's strong SU2 or two are strong SU2?
I have two strong SU2s,
okay.
one which acts on this set of Xi's. And then I have a different set of Xi primes on which a different SU2 acts on. So I think
now it makes so. What Peskin was doing is he was making first two a doublet of SU2,
right?
Which is a subgroup of your embedding.
Right. The question, that's tricky because then there is a tricky question which you have to ask, which is there is something which is not eaten, and you have to be sure that thing which isn't eaten doesn't roll off and acquire a web to change the pattern. But here, that freedom is not there. Because every single thing is eaten. That figuring this out, exactly how this works, took more time than everything else in the paper. This whole alignment business. But
I see it with the lack of alignment. I mean, the two, I think, it's very break into as you two.
Right. Okay. So that is still left over, right? Because
okay.
I can prove. So what I've shown is that if you have just one SU2 with four flavors, everything is eaten, right? But you're right. It's not clear from anything I've said that the second SU2 will condense in the same direction as the first one. And so it's not clear that you have SU2 cross U1 left over. But here's the thing. Okay. This is what makes this little Higgs theory in particular very special. In this theory, every Goldstone boson that's not eaten is little. In other words, it's none of the Goldstone bosons will acquire a mass at one loop. Okay, and what that means is, from the effective field theory point of view, I can actually calculate the effective potential for the five guys which are not eaten, and I can dynamically determine the pattern. In other words, I don't know for sure whether in the end I have SU2 cross U1 or something else. Okay. But because all the Goldstone bosons in this theory are little, none of them has a quadratically divergent mass. So I can actually calculate the effective potential, which only contains logs, and I have confidence that I know all the signs of the various terms. So I can calculate the effective potential and figure out what the pattern of symmetry breaking is. Which turns out to be correct. But I didn't do that. Schmolz did that. Okay. Schmolz's analysis works because all the Goldstone bosons are little. For example, in the littlest Higgs, you couldn't do this. For example, I could write down a theory which gives the pattern of breaking the littlest Higgs, but I would never be able to prove that that in the end it gives the pattern I want, because there are things which get a quadratic divergent mass at one loop, and I would have to make an assumption about signs. Here I don't have to make any assumptions about signs, because all the Goldstone bosons are little. So Schmaltz's analysis is just correct.
In fact, this requires some fine-tuning, right?
This model?
Because you don't want the exact alignment, because you do want to break it like truly symmetric. You just have to want to misalign a little bit.
Nothing.
Right. Now, if you just take a gauge loop and then go some more down, you get positive mass square. Then the top loop gives you negative mass square. So.
Yeah, so that's really the 10% fine-tuning I showed earlier. You know, I said there's 1 in 10 fine-tuning left over. Right? And that comes down to the fact that there's some tuning left over to get a little bit of electrovolt breaking. But the fact is, it is still calculable. Okay? And it's calculable only because all the Goldstone bosons are little. If you have a general little Higgs theory, you wouldn't be able to do the calculation I'm doing now without making one or two extra assumptions. Okay, good. All right, so the low energy effective theory can once again be described by a nonlinear sigma model. So I parametrize the pseudo Goldstones as pi's again, and so I have something like this. And these matrices T are the generators of SU4 mod SP4. And really, there are two sets of A's, A1 and A2, corresponding to Xi1 and Xi2. And the low-energy effective theory will consist of all operators involving the two A's, consistent with the non-linearly realizing matrices. These are the A's. Okay. But here's the thing. Now, in principle, what I should do is I should write down the low-energy effective theory with all the A's and redo the calculation that Schmaltz did in terms of the A's and figure out the pattern of symmetry breaking, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I don't want to do that, because Schmaltz has already done a huge amount of work, and I don't want to reproduce his analysis. Okay. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to cheat. And the way I'm going to do that is, what I'm going to do is I'm only going to keep the SU3 cross U1 subgroup of each SU4 manifest. Okay. So the theory really has SU4 symmetry. I choose to keep only SU3 cross U1 manifest. And when I do that, I can immediately carry over most of the results of the original calculation by Schmaltz during the alignment to this new construction. So to see this, see how A decomposes under SU3 cross U1. Previously, I had phi1 and phi2 being the two different Higgses of the simplest little Higgs, but here in our abuse of notation, what I have is one single triplet phi. And phi1, phi2, phi3 are the three components. Okay. And this is the way A breaks up into SU3 cross U1. So you can see it contains one SU3 triplet phi. So this is the identity. Yeah. So this is the identification of. This is how a phi fits in A. And once you have done this, you can identify the pi's in A with the pi's and the triplets phi. So what I mean is, so I had this formula earlier for the pi's that are contained in the object phi, which transforms